I want to welcome to the show Kat Delancey. Kat is the proud mother of two children, and Kat crossed my news path about a week ago when I saw her on a lot of our major news outlets because she was sharing the story of losing her young son, Ronan. And just as a human, as a mother, despite what I do for a living, this woman is courageous, incredible, strong, blessed to have an amazing, it seems like, husband and daughter and community surrounding her. And the fact that she's got the strength weeks after this tremendous loss to share it with the world is just profound. So, Kat, I want to first of all just thank you for trusting me to share your story and to come on and share it with all of our listeners. And of course, give you my deepest sympathies to you and your family. My condolences. I can't imagine what you guys are going through. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you, Melissa. And I'm really happy that you're taking the time out to share his story, because that's really what my goal is here, is to let people know about this virus and what actually happened.
So take us back. You're pregnant. Your healthy pregnancy, right? No complications, nothing going on. And you have baby Ronan. This was in May. What happened?
Yep. Yeah, so he was born May 21st and completely healthy, full term, good weight, had, you know, the best chance of survival as what I thought. We brought him home for the hospital. He was only home for about 10 days. And then I started noticing that he was just acting a little bit different. He was really irritable one night, and he had like redness on his face and on his chest. So I ended up bringing him into the pediatrician's office for a sick visit. And at that visit, you know, he had a full exam. They didn't see anything wrong. He didn't have a fever at that point in time, which I don't know if that is typical. The, you know, every doctor has commented on the parechovirus and said that it causes a fever, and he didn't have one at home. He didn't have one in the doctor's office. He never had one in the hospital either. So the doctor basically told me that, you know, he was fine. He was gassy and maybe it's colic, and gave me some tips on what to do about that. So I went home and, you know, thought my baby was fine at that point, but I still had a nagging feeling in the back of my head that something was wrong. So less than 12 hours later, I was bringing him into the hospital and brought him in, told them exactly what had happened during the day, said he's fussier. He seems really tired now, and he has redness on him. And one of the big things was he wasn't feeding as well at that point. So they checked him out, and as they were doing triage on him, they realized his oxygen saturation, which is supposed to be 100%, was down to 70, and then it quickly went down to 20, and then him back. They intubated him. Yeah, they intubated him, and, you know, a little bit later, one of the doctors was like, was that a seizure? I don't know. Was that a seizure? Let's check it out. So they started running all sorts of tests and, you know, checking for any sort of virus that could be in his system. And then the more that they watched, the more that they thought, you know, one of the nurses actually was in tune to it and was like, he's doing these little movements with his eyes and, you know, kind of flicking his tongue. Was he doing that before? And I said, you know, I thought I was being crazy for thinking this, but I thought that was weird. And babies make weird movements. So maybe it was just, I don't know, he was tired or something else. And she goes, yeah, you know, it could be nothing, but it could be seizures. Let's get him on an EEG. So they did, and it showed he had seizure activity. They did an MRI, and it showed he had, you know, already had brain damage at that point in time, and nobody knew why. So running test after test after test, and, you know, it was a few days before they ended up finding anything. You know, it was horrible not knowing. It was horrible having a child in the hospital, and we were actually so happy when a diagnosis was found, not only because it gave us some sort of reason and sort of like hope for a cure, but it also, you know, the infectious disease doctors at that time said, babies recover from this. He's going to leave the hospital. So we were thrilled. We were like, okay, well, he'll get better. You know, the brain damage might be reversible. You know, maybe the seizures will go away. And, you know, we had all of high hopes at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And things just never went in that direction. You know, he continued having seizures. He wasn't able to maintain his body temperature. It was just keeping him on supportive therapy the entire time he was in the hospital. He was on a ventilator the entire time. He had to be in a medically induced coma to try and keep the seizures under control. And the hope was that the more rest his brain got, the more that the inflammation would go down and the more that the seizure activity would stop. And it never did. So, he tried fighting as hard as he could, and there was really nothing else that could be done.
So you're hearing from Kat Delancey this morning, an incredible mother who went through, I think, the worst thing any person should ever have to go through. And she lost her son, Ronan, at 34 days. 34 days he was here with us. Yeah. To what's called parechovirus. It's something that a lot of us have never even heard of before. And we're learning a lot more about it. And the whole point of bringing Ronan's story to life is so people know and can proactively handle this situation. Kat Delancey is here and she's sharing her story about her son Ronan when he contracted parechovirus. And Kat, had you ever heard of this before? Like, had you ever heard of this virus?
No. It didn't even seem like any of the nurses or doctors had really heard of it when it was first found.
So in the doctors that I've spoken to since this became public, Ronan's story became public, it sounds like they've seen like a slight increase or something, or they're starting to see more cases in the last 5 years. And even though they only have a certain number that are recorded, they believe it could be like hundreds of thousands of kids every single year contracting this. And what's astonishing to me, which reminds me a lot of the COVID era, is unless you test for it, there are probably a lot of kids who go undiagnosed. Or in Ronan's case, it's too late once you do catch it. What would be your suggestion to other parents to avoid what you and your family have had to go through?
So I totally agree with everything he was saying. And that's my main mission is to raise awareness so that, you know, pediatricians are aware, families are aware, and just in general that something can be done in the future. Because in our case, we don't know if things would have been different if it was found at a sooner point. What we could assume is if it was caught sooner, you know, he would have been in the hospital days before that. You know, we didn't have any sick contacts or anything that led us to believe that he was actually truly sick. And the hospital, it was days until it got diagnosed, and maybe he could have had different treatment if that had started. So the scary part is, you know, words of advice for parents, I don't really have great ones except for listen to your gut. And, you know, if you feel like your child is sick, you're the expert there. You're the one who knows exactly how your child is. And if I had initially listened to the pediatrician and said, oh, everything was fine, it was just gas, my child probably would have died at home. And unfortunately, the outcome for us wasn't much better, but we have answers now, and we have something that hopefully the medical community can now be aware of, that it is in our community and it is causing huge effects. Mm-hmm. So it is very much like COVID in the fact that if it's not tested for, we don't necessarily know. And maybe the fact that we're calling this rare is misleading, and it's leading people to think, oh, it could never happen to me, and there's nothing that needs to be done about it.
I agree. I also think it's bizarre, Kat, if I could add 2 cents here. I think it's bizarre that when you get your child a blood test done, that you, the parent, have to request it to be tested for parechovirus. I found that interesting because in speaking to doctors, when they said, you know, like when I hear hundreds of thousands of children, you know, I have a 4-year-old. I'm thinking, wow, I've never even heard of this before. And if I've never even heard of it, what would make me think to request that to be tested for? I'm surprised when you have that many kids who have tested positive for it, that they don't automatically add that to the blood test. Like they test for the flu and they test for, you know, probably COVID now. But I've never heard of this before. And like, I have a mom who's a registered nurse. I used to be a health reporter. I've never heard of this before. And I think unless you're a parent who's heard the news, you know, or unfortunately has gone through it, like, I think it's crazy that doctors don't automatically test for that when you see some of these symptoms pop up. I think that's really surprising.
Well, the other reason why Dr. Wong and I are trying to raise awareness is it's not just that every baby gets as sick as Ronan does.
Mm-hmm.
And it can cause, like, long-term effects from having a cold. And I don't think those, like, if we're not tracking it, we don't necessarily know that. The way that I'm aware of this now is from seeing all these parents in a Facebook group who had this virus, like, years ago in Australia and the UK, and all of them are making connections now, like, my child is autistic, my child has cerebral palsy, my child has this issue. And, you know, these children were very sick, went to the hospital, and they found a diagnosis. But there's other children who don't get quite as sick but still can have these long-term consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So we should be testing for it so that they know, A, so hopefully, you know, a vaccine or medications can be created to treat it so it doesn't cause these effects, but also so parents can know, you know, okay, my child had a virus. They might need physical therapy long down the line. They might need occupational therapy. They might need other things, speech therapy, to help them. I have a friend who also was a nurse who had a child who had enterovirus as an infant, and she didn't even know that her child should have some sort of treatment afterwards, and she's only noticing now how delayed her speech is. And, you know, that could be something that the sooner that you act on it, the better the outcome will be for the child.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
So it just needs to be talked about more.
It does. It certainly does. And Kat, I would really love, I know this is very early on in your journey, but if there's anything that comes beyond just awareness, if you know, if there's ever like a, you know, a fundraiser, a nonprofit, if there's a, you know, anything that can bring awareness to this, or you know, be able to raise money maybe for PSAs or for research on this or for testing or whatever the case may be, please, if you don't mind, keep me posted. I would love nothing more than to support your cause and what you're trying to do in informing the public about this. And in keeping our kids safer and just being more in the know. I appreciate what you're doing and would love to be a part of it in any way that I could.
Thank you. And absolutely. I mean, I already have the wheels turning to hopefully have a fundraiser in August. And I've been connecting with parents actually across the globe who have done similar things and have been, you know, choosing labs that they hope will be able to investigate these viruses more in depth to have some antiviral in the future, some mm-hmm. vaccine in the future. And I think if we can, like, globally work on this the same way that a vaccine was developed for COVID, we have a higher likelihood of getting something done and avoiding these long-term consequences, or in our case, like, losing our child.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Kat DeLancey, I thank you so much for coming on to the show, sharing your story, and certainly I would love to speak to you again in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Kat DeLancey here on WICC. A Connecticut family is still trying to wrap their brain around what happened earlier this year. Ronan DeLancey was born on May 21st, 2022. Doctors, however, learned days later that the infant was suffering from a variant of human parechovirus. And though they held out hope that he would survive, Ronan DeLancey died at 34 days old in his mother's arms. It's just an incredibly tragic story. And what is amazing is the family of Ronan, they want to share his story because they don't want other families to go through what they did, which was purely having no idea what this virus was or that it existed in their child. So joining us this morning to, first of all, just break down what this virus is, how you can contract it, is Dr. Andrew Wong, back on the show with us this morning, a primary care physician with Hartford HealthCare's medical group in Westport. Dr. Wong, thanks for coming on. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good to be here.
What is parechovirus? I've never even heard of this mm-hmm. before.
Parechovirus is a single-stranded RNA virus, and it's in the family of viruses that we call picornaviruses that have been around that we know of since the 1950s, but we've always looked at them as, you know, kind of like a seven-day virus. Other forms of picornaviruses are Coxsackie, enterovirus, and so we've always regarded them in the medical profession as viruses that cause kind of a triad of symptoms, a rash, fever, and irritability, but that the babies, infants, usually recover. And over the last 5 years, we've begun to realize that through mutations and more virulent subtypes, these viruses, particularly parechovirus, can actually be fatal, and if not fatal, can cause lifelong debilities.
I'm going to ask a question, and this isn't to spread, if you will, fake news. Does COVID have anything to do with this uptick?
No, but I think that there's a scary parallel with how COVID or coronavirus was also regarded as a cold virus that was temporary and did not cause major illness or long-term side effects. And in a lot of coronavirus patients I'm seeing, they develop conditions like diabetes, cognitive defects, heart conditions like pericarditis. And we have to wonder, what are the factors that are causing these normally previously benign viruses to become so serious and to cause long-lasting side effects? There's a lot of implications behind that, but the parechovirus is a separate type of virus from coronavirus.
How do you contract it, Dr. Wong? Because what's interesting about this story is Ronan was born healthy. So how did he get this virus, especially because his family was so, it sounds like they were so proactive. Like I was watching one of the stories that Kat was interviewed on, and she said, you know, we were so careful because we were having a COVID baby, like we were having a baby during COVID times, that how did he even contract this virus?
Yeah, that's what we're not 100% sure of. So Ronan was home for about 10 days before he started to develop symptoms. It takes about 4 or 5 days to exhibit symptoms once you've been exposed, but it is very possible that baby Ronan was exposed to the virus in the hospital. Ronan also has siblings and, has an older sister. So who knows? It came from somebody, whether it was in the hospital or after Ronan got home. They were focusing a lot on wearing masks and making sure that no one with coronavirus symptoms came close to him. Parechovirus spreads more through particles that we kind of put in our mouth. So babies are constantly putting their fingers in their mouth. And so it spreads differently. So it may have gotten spread through a different mechanism.
We're talking to Dr. Andrew Wong this morning about parechovirus, something I had never really heard of before this news story broke last week in Connecticut, where a family had to say goodbye to their child at 34 days old because he had contracted parechovirus. And something else that Ronan's family had reported is seizures. And what I thought was interesting is they said it's not like adult seizures, like some of the things that Ronan was going through. Like they didn't even realize at first he was having seizures. So I didn't know if you could talk about that. Is that something common if you have parechovirus? Like, what are some things that people should be looking for if, in fact, their children contract this?
Yeah, it's very important to notice what the initial symptoms are so that you can be aware of it and immediately talk to your pediatrician about it. And the initial symptoms are going to be a fever in combination with something that we call exanthems. Exanthems are a fancy term for a reactive rash. That reactive rash can be on the hands, it can be on the feet. Sometimes we see it on the torso. So it's kind of like a speckly rash that we see in babies. And then the third thing is going to be irritability. They're going to be crying, not happy. A lot of the times they don't eat. And then the neurologic symptoms. So parechovirus is becoming more and more correlated with meningitis as well as encephalopathy. Now, the coronaviruses that parechovirus belongs to, one form of coronavirus is polio. And polio, as we know, causes severe acute flaccid myelitis, or a polio-like condition where the baby is unable to move their extremities and they get very bad muscle debility, some brain debilities. And so we're seeing a little bit of overlap between parechovirus and even enteroviruses, which are closely related in causing these brain and neurologic symptoms. And unfortunately, that's what happened with baby Ronan, is that the infection did get to the brain and began to cause seizure activity. It also caused him to stop breathing, almost like a SIDS-like syndrome.
Oh, gosh, what a horrible story. Dr. Andrew Wong is here this morning, and we are asking questions about parechovirus, and he's a primary care physician with Hartford Healthcare Medical Group in Westport. So a couple more questions for you, Dr. Wong. First of all, can you get tested for this?
Yes, we have testing available through a PCR. Usually we use blood tests. Now, the problem is that we don't regard parechovirus as a first-line diagnostic test, meaning that the common convention is that when a baby or an adult comes into the office with a fever and rash, we test them for flu, we test them for COVID, we test them for strep throat, but we don't ordinarily test them for parechovirus. And that's one of the messages I wanted to get out, is that when your baby or a friend's baby, loved one's baby, has these symptoms, fever, rash, irritability, request that a parechovirus and an enterovirus test be done as a first-line test. We don't know how prevalent this virus is because we're not testing for it. And so last year, there were only 3,000 cases of picornaviruses diagnosed. But the reality is that it's hundreds of thousands of babies that get this every year. And to realize, I think, the implications of these viruses, now that they've become more deadly, more serious over the last 5 years, we should start testing for them to find that correlation. And a lot of babies with SIDS on postmortem analysis were found to have parechovirus.
Wow. So it's something that you should proactively ask for when you're getting your child tested.
Yes, 100%.
Wow. And I mean, when you say, so in your professional opinion, hundreds of thousands of cases a year, so that's pretty, that to me sounds more common than most people realize.
Oh, definitely. In just 5 years ago, it used to be a calming phrase to say, it's just a virus, you'll get better. And now, mostly because of the coronavirus, it's almost like a bad phrase now. It's just a virus, because we're realizing that viruses can get very serious. Mm-hmm. It can cause, they're mutating to more malignant forms. And also we're realizing the long-term effects of a lot of these viruses. So several years ago, there was an enterovirus outbreak, and it turned out that a lot of the babies, and all the babies survived the enterovirus infections, but many of them developed neuromuscular weakness and they had to get physical therapy. There were real musculoskeletal milestones that were missed, even some neurodevelopmental delays as a result of the enterovirus. And so we need to first be able to diagnose it effectively, and then we can find out what the correlations are.
Wow. Dr. Andrew Wong, I really appreciate you sharing all this information with us. And again, one of the biggest takeaways from this interview is if you or someone you know has a newborn or has a young child who is showing any kind of symptom, please request from your doctors when you get their testing, their blood test done, to have it tested for parechovirus. And again, Dr. Wong, I thank you so much for coming on and sharing all this with us on the air.
You're welcome, Melissa. Thank you.
All right. Dr. Wong here on WICC. Want to welcome to the show Bob Stefanowski, Republican candidate running for governor 2022. Good morning, Bob. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hello, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm glad to have you here, Bob, and looking forward to having you on several times. I'm excited because we've been getting a lot of questions, obviously. We're getting closer and closer to the election, and a lot of people will call in or email me questions specifically for you. And I thought, well, you know what? We need to start having Bob on a little more frequently so I don't have like these major, because I think I sent you a boatload of questions. We'll try to get through as many as we can. They all
sure.
came from listeners, so these are questions
Excellent.
Directly from your constituents. All right. Well, let's go to Jessica in Westport. She said, Bob, if you become governor, what, if anything, would change in regards to abortion?
Yeah, I'm really, really happy you asked me this question, because there's a lot of fear-mongering out there. I'll start with I do support a woman's right to choose. I think Connecticut's law is where it should be. It limits late-stage procedures. It supports a woman's right to choose in the first trimester. You're going to hear a lot of noise coming out of the Democratic side because they don't want to talk about inflation, Melissa. They don't want to talk about gas prices. They want to talk about this. And I think Connecticut's law is where it should be. And by the way, it is law. You hear a lot of noise coming out of Washington. The policies with respect to a woman's right to choose are codified in Connecticut state law. It's not going to change when I'm governor. The one thing I do think we should have is I think we should have parental notification. Governor Lamont believes that a 13-year-old girl trying to make a tough decision like this, or 12 or whoever, sitting up in her bedroom at night worrying about it, the parents don't have a right to talk to that girl about it. I think a parent should have the right to have notification. That's the main difference between his policy and ours. But please, if your listeners, don't let them fearmonger you that just because of Roe v. Wade, well, not just because, it's dramatic in other parts of the country, but in Connecticut, it's not an issue. The law is going to stay the same, and women are going to be protected.
And thank you, Bob, for differentiating, because I know, as you mentioned, that, look, in the next few months, you and I, we're no strangers to this. We're going to hear a lot coming out of both sides, and I really appreciate you clarifying that, because I do remember a few months back, I think, having a soundbite from our partners at News 8 that there was that issue of parental notification, and it's hard to disagree with that, you know, that there should be somebody, because we're not even fully developed at 12, 13 years old to make that kind of a decision, and whether the parent agrees with it or not, to make that kind of a decision, right. You know, like even to get a tattoo, you know, if I wanted to get a tattoo in right. High school, I needed a parental signature. So I understand where you're coming
right.
from. Absolutely.
I think in general, we've got to get some rights back to parents. I think, in my opinion, I think government, both at a national and a state level, has gotten between a parent and their child. I think we need to get the rights back to parents and kitchen table issues. If you want to talk about things with your kid, that's up to you. But I don't think we should be forcing things. I don't think we should be preventing parents from knowing their girl is, you know, going through something like that and can't even consult with her. I think the governor's taken a very extreme position on Roe v. Wade. He's also not been clear on whether he supports late-term abortion or not. That came up in a Senate bill coming up. Richard Blumenthal had a bill that would have allowed, in certain cases, termination of a pregnancy right up to the moment before birth. And Governor Lamont supported that policy. So I'm very glad that you asked it, because I think my position is very reasonable. It's very in line. And I would argue that the governor's position on these issues is a bit extreme.
We're talking to Bob Stefanowski this morning, taking your questions. Rita in Bridgeport had this to ask you, Bob. How do you feel about required vaccinations? So as you know, Bob, there was a new law put into place not too long ago, and basically you couldn't really, there was kind of a grandfather clause, but essentially if you're entering public school, you are required to get certain vaccinations or you will be denied to go to classes in person. And so her question is, would you keep that law in place? And then her second question was, do you believe COVID shots should be added to the list?
Well, first of all, I believe in vaccinations, right? I was vaccinated. My girls, three girls were vaccinated. We all have the COVID shot and the booster. So I do think they work. I do think, and most states have this, a very narrow exemption for religious reasons might make sense. 26 states have it. We got rid of it. You know, when you look at the number of kids that are unvaccinated, I believe the number is about 30,000. Only six of those were for religious reasons. So once again, I when I'm governor, I don't want to pick winners and losers. There's a lot of other reasons why kids in school aren't vaccinated right now. And again, my kids are, and I would hope that everybody else does that. But, you know, a lot of it is lack of access to health care. There's other reasons besides religious. So to go in and pass a bill that targets families. I mean, you've got families right now where one of their kids is in seventh grade because they've been grandfathered in, and another kid is about to go into kindergarten and they're excluded. So it's a really complicated issue. I don't think it should be, if you do have an exemption, it needs to be very, very narrow because vaccinations work. But again, it gets back to parents and being able to make decisions about their kids. For kids, I would not add the COVID vaccine to that list. You look at the vaccines available right now, Melissa, and only, I think, 3%, less than 3% of parents have voluntarily gotten their kids vaccinated.
You're right.
And if they want to do that, they should absolutely have the ability to do it. We should give them access, the ability, but forcing people to do things coming from government, I try to limit the amount of things we force on people from government.
Thank you for your questions. Got actually a couple of questions just during that commercial break. We're talking to Bob Stefanowski this morning, Republican candidate for governor 2022. So, Bob, let's get right back into it. Gary in West Haven just called asking about your views on unions. He said, you know what? I voted for Bob, years ago. I voted for Bob, but a number of my friends did not because they were under the impression that Bob is anti-union. Could you speak to this, if that's true or not, or what your stance is?
These are terrific questions. I should come on every week because it's great to be able to address a lot of the rhetoric out there. I am not anti-union. I mean, how could you be against law enforcement, which is unionized? How could you be against that person who decided not to go into the private sector, worked at a union for 30 years, and is now entitled to their retirement? As first-time candidate, Melissa, I made some mistakes on statements I made. I'm 100% behind state employees and private sector, you know, people that are working hard. The problem in my mind is Governor Lamont doesn't treat everybody fairly. And I don't have a problem with the bonuses that he gave unions because it was largely a catch-up for raises from prior years. But when you're given one set of people, it cost $1.7 billion. And I've never turned down a raise in my private sector career. I've never turned down a bonus. I get it. The workers shouldn't turn that down. But when the governor gives $1.7 billion to 50,000 state employees and $600 million to the rest of the 3.6 million people of Connecticut, that's not right. There needs to be more equity there. And by the way, it happens in an election year. So when I'm governor, I'm not going to just take care of people in an election year. I'm going to do the right thing, whether you're unionized or not. I'm going to do the right thing for you for 4 years, such that in year four, I don't have to pay, you know, what I consider is a big payment to get your vote using taxpayer money. So the unions work hard. People in unions work hard. We just need to be fair. We need to treat everybody equally. And in my opinion, in an election year, the governor's doing everything he can to get that union vote. And I understand it. It's part of politics, but we should be treating everybody. We have people struggling right now. They're trying to decide whether to make a rent payment, buy gas for their car, fill up their oil tank, or buy their prescription medicine. We got to do something for people, Melissa. And at the same time people are struggling, we've got a $3.5 billion cash surplus up in Hartford. We need to do something to help everybody.
So let's talk about that money, because that was a question we got from Jeff in Waterbury, also Albert in Stamford, and Terry in Bridgeport, all wondering about the extra cash that Connecticut has. If you were governor right now, Bob Stefanowski, what would you have done with the extra money that the state got, not only during COVID, but that we had saved? And also, I think a second question, if you don't mind answering both, is would you consider getting rid of state income tax, for example, or really any other taxes?
Well, on taxes, we should immediately lower the sales tax, because with inflation prices going up, you could lower the sales tax, give some people relief, and not lose any money. Number two is there's still a 25-cent per gallon gas tax on regular gas. Why in the world are we collecting more money from people on gas when the prices are highest in the history of the world? Governor Lamont raised the tax on diesel fuel on July 1st. Why in the world would we do that? Because the truckers can't afford that extra 50 cents per gallon. They're going to pass it down to us and it makes groceries more expensive. We could be giving immediate relief on that. Governor Lamont put a new tax in, a 1% tax on prepared food. Let's get rid of that one permanently. But at a minimum, let's defer the taxes on gas, give people some relief, and relook at it in the fall. And let's get rid of some of these other taxes that we don't need and give some immediate relief, Melissa. I really don't understand why the governor's not doing that, because people are struggling out there. We've got the money to help them. He had the power to do it. He's a Democratic governor with a Democratic legislature. I don't understand why we wouldn't do it now. He should call a special session and do it and give people some relief.
And Bob, we unfortunately are running out of time. So one more question. I'm going to take this one from Monica in Ridgefield. Monica says, Bob, what is the difference this time around? What do you think is the difference this time going up against Governor Lamont versus last time?
Yeah, I got to come on more, Melissa. These are terrific questions. First of all, I'll be honest. first-time candidates, I made mistakes. You know, I'd never run for office before. This time, my platform is broader. It's not just about income tax. It's about affordability. We didn't have a chance to talk about it, but it's about public safety. We've got to reinvest in our police forces. Crime is out of control in Connecticut right now. I'm going to reinvest and make sure that people are safer. I'm going to make it more affordable in Connecticut. We didn't have a time to talk about energy prices. We need to regulate and have some teeth to Eversource and the other power companies out there and get rates down. There's a lot of things we can be doing. Connecticut is a terrific state. I've been here my whole life. I grew up in New Haven. That's why I want to be governor, to actually put people first, put politics aside, make it safer, more affordable, and as importantly, Melissa, give parents the right back to raise their kids. People in Connecticut are not asking for a lot right now. We can do it.
And Bob, just so you know, you are welcome to come back on whenever you want. I'm hoping to work with your team. You have an excellent team. Would love to try to get you on maybe like an every other week basis. Would love
Absolutely.
To get you on the show. Yeah, because we, we get a lot of questions. So I really appreciate you taking the extra time this morning. Thank you so much for your honesty and being here. And I look forward to having you on very soon.
Good. Let's do it every other week. I'm in.
Looking forward to it. Bob Stefanowski right here on WICC. And you heard it right here. Bob's going to come back hopefully in another couple of weeks. And we do have a lot more questions that you guys sent in. And I thank you so much. And we'll continue to ask those questions the next time he comes on. The Power to Be Jewelry Collection was created to empower people with inspirational phrases. And now the founding sisters of that popular jewelry line have put those words into action. They have donated nearly $3,000 to charity to help families and children. And you may remember them. I had these incredible sisters on my show months ago. We've got Christina and Ray back on the show, back to tell us how they took their Oscar success earlier this year and launched several bracelet campaigns to raise money both locally and nationally. Ladies, welcome back. I'm so glad you're here. Good morning.
Thanks, Melissa, for having us again.
Yeah, I love that you guys are here. And for anyone who maybe doesn't remember your story, don't know how because I replayed it like a bunch of times, give us your background and tell us a little bit about the jewelry business.
Yeah, sure. So we are a third-generation family business. And we have a family jewelry store in Glastonbury, Connecticut. And Christina and I created our own collection of positive affirmation power word bracelets that we have called the Power to Be.
And I remember your stories because it was something that resonated with me. I think it was both of you that had gone through fertility issues, miscarriages, things like that. Because I as well have gone through that as well. Wasn't that one of the reasons you guys launched this line?
Yes. Yep. So Christina and I went through 6 years of fertility struggles with our determination to become moms. And we used positive affirmations to help us through this challenging time. And we knew if it worked for us, that it could work for tons of other women.
Mm-hmm. Now, your collection, it debuted at the Oscar Awards earlier this year, which was one of the reasons we connected, encouraging people to tap into their strength with different affirmations of like being strong, fearless, limitless, fierce. Tell us a little bit, how did you even come up with these six phrases? Like, where did that even come about?
Well, that was actually really fun because we only want to make things that, you know, our customers or ask for and people will be impacted by. So we took a survey from like hundreds of women. We were like, anyone we knew, worked with, could come across, we would ask them, what kind of words would feel powerful to them. And these five, after all of that and doing some, like adding some actual market research too, these top five are what came up.
I love it. Which one is your favorite?
Oh my gosh, I choose a new one every day. Today, I wear Be Strong every day. And today, when I choose a new one every morning, I've got all the bracelets in my closet. Today was Be Limitless for me.
Okay. And let's see, am I talking to Christina or Ray right now?
You're talking to Chrissy. Hi.
So then Ray, which one do you like? Which one is your favorite?
So Be Strong is also a staple for me every day, but I always add on a little Be Fierce or a little Be Fearless when I'm feeling either one of those.
Yeah, I love that. And we're talking this morning to Chrissy and Ray. So excited to have them back on the show. Just you guys just beam sunshine. It's amazing.
Thank you.
You can feel it through the phone. Yeah.
We try.
You guys succeed. And they created the Power to Be. It's a jewelry collection, and they are part of a very long-standing family business. And it actually opened back up in 1948, and they've continued on with that legacy. So what inspired you to custom create bracelets for charity? Like, how did you make that connection, that bridge?
Well, we love any type of philanthropy and giving back and doing what we can to help and inspire and uplift and empower anybody we can. We know that the fertility in particular was such a struggle for us, and financially it's really difficult for people to afford. So we figured if we could give back in any way that we can, we would create a Power Word bracelet specifically for fertility in blue and gold. And then, you know, it was doing really well. And we also thought current events that are going on, like the Robb Elementary School shooting, we knew we had to do something in that community too. So we created also in their signature color, the maroon and gold Power Word bracelet for them.
Oh, that's so beautiful. These look so extraordinary. Now, these are they on your website? Like, if people wanted to go to your website and
yeah.
Okay. So they could still support these charities. They could by buying one of these bracelets.
Absolutely. They can. We wrote a check to these charities just recently. We were so proud, almost $3,000, and we still have a limited quantity left of these charity bracelets, which are available on our website. And we will be tracking it, and we will send the rest of the money along the way as the last few sell.
Until we are sold out.
Yep, that's right.
I mean, I think that's so wonderful. And again, if you want to check out these bracelets or any of the ones that they typically sell as well, you can go to The Power to Be. And again, it's just the letter B, not B-E or B-E-E. It's The Power to
Be. Thank you for clarifying that. Yes.
Oh,
just
yes.
Just the B. The
yes.
Power to Be.
Well, it's funny because when you guys came on the first time around, I cannot tell you how many people were like, Melissa, sorry, the website doesn't work. I'm like, no, it does work. There's just, you're putting too many letters in there. So The Power to Be, just the letter B.com, and your whole story is up there, a beautiful picture of the two of you.
Yep.
And just it's extraordinary. I love your website. I'm curious.
Thanks, Melissa.
Yeah, before I let you guys go though, you know, what charity kind of pulls at your heart? Like, who do you think you'll go to next, or will you kind of see where the wind blows, if you will?
We are in talks of a few different things right now. We haven't nailed down exactly or specifically which charity that we are going to engage in next. We like to spread the love, so nothing's off the table, but we love supporting children and education and things like that.
And anything that makes people feel like empowered and powerful, any charity that's up to that, you know, that's who we're seeking out next.
And we're big mental health advocates too. So that's also something that we're looking into.
That's fantastic. So Chrissy and Ray, I love having you on the show. You are welcome back anytime you want. And if people are interested.
Thank you.
Absolutely. No, I think you guys are wonderful. And if anyone's interested in buying one of these beautiful bracelets and also supporting a charity while you're at it, head on over to The Power to Be, the letter B, thepowertobe.com. Thank you both so much for coming on. I love talking to you.
Thank you, Melissa. We appreciate you.
Too.
Appreciate
it. Just sunshine. They're pure sunshine. You're so welcome. So glad to have you guys here. I look forward to having you again really soon.